This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Sexual assault on college campuses is not new. A recent study by the Bureau of Justice Statistics says that 1 in 5 female undergraduates have experienced some kind of sexual assault while in college. What is new is the fact that attitudes about those assaults are changing. For decades, victims of sexual assault were reluctant to report the incidents for a number of reasons, including fear of retribution and a lack of support from the colleges and universities themselves. But now, as campuses add more support services, the number of incidents being reported is on the rise, and victims' advocates regard that as a positive trend. UNC Charlotte is one of the campuses leading the way. In 2013, only 3 cases of sexual assault were reported there. The following year, the number rose to 32. According to the U.S. Department of Education, it's one of the largest jumps in the country in the reporting of assault. In the book We Believe You, 2 UNC Chapel Hill alums share the stories of students from every kind of college and university, large, small, public, private, and both authors join us for the hour. Annie Clark and Andrea Pino are also co-founders of End Rape on Campus. Ms. Clark was a lead complainant in the Title IX and Cleary complaints against UNC Chapel Hill. She also helped write the bipartisan Campus Accountability and Safety Act. Andrea Pino is director of policy and support with End Rape on Campus. Her work and her personal story were the subject of a documentary called The Hunting Ground. Actually, both appeared in The Hunting Ground, which premiered at the 2015 Sundance Film Festival, and both join us from the studios of NPR in Washington. Good morning. Welcome.
Hi, Mike. Thanks so much for having us.
Thanks.
You're welcome. And both have returned from Europe with cold, so I hope we can get through this without any major problems here. And with us in our studio is Terry Rhodes, Associate Director of the Counseling Center at UNC Charlotte and Director of Training at the center there. Welcome to you as well.
Good morning.
The Hunting Ground was the subject of a lot of notoriety at the Oscars. Lady Gaga was there singing Diane Warren's song, which was nominated for an award, and all of the people featured in the film, I believe, were on stage, and that means that you are up there as well, Annie and Andre. Is that correct?
Hi. Yes, a lot of us from the Hunting Ground film were there. Not everyone was there, and about 12 of our contributors from the book We Believe You were on stage as well. So there were 51 of us total at the Oscars this year.
That must have been a not only a great experience for you, but a great experience for the cause.
Yeah, and I'll agree with Annie. It was a pretty surreal experience to be there. and I think also what's been really exciting has been getting to know the people. When putting the book together, they became some of our best friends. And really just seeing 50 people united on stage was pretty incredible. And it was also incredible for Lady Gaga herself.
Yeah. Before we talk about how things are changing in the campus world with regard to the reporting of sexual assault, let's talk for a moment about the two of you, Andy Clark and Andrea Pino. You came to found this organization, End Rape on Campus, and to co-write this or co-edit this book, We Believe You. You were both victims of rape by strangers, which I'm told is rare because most people, most victims know their assailants. Did this happen to you both while you were in college?
Yeah, so I was a sophomore when it happened to me, and I think what's interesting about the book and also what we're seeing with increased media coverage on this issue is that it is really rare for it to be a stranger, and it's much more likely to be a person that you know. In my incident, it was a student on campus, and that's actually the higher percentage is that it's likely a person of that community, and that's what makes universities, struggle with dealing with this issue is recognizing that oftentimes both parties are members of the community, and both parties in a sense might have a right to stay at the university, and it is difficult to really recognize how it is that you can create a safer campus without actually recognizing that both people really are part of that community.
And for me, I was a first-year student, and I was actually off campus. And as you said, it's very rare to have a stranger attack. It's 80 to 90% people you know, particularly within the college community in that age range, 18 to 24. And so what we did when we came forward against UNC, it wasn't really about our own experiences or just about UNC. It was really filing a complaint to show that this is a microcosm of what happens on a national scale. It's not, we didn't have any sort of vendetta against UNC. It wasn't to make UNC UNC look bad. It's you love something and therefore you hold it accountable. And we wanted to make UNC the best that it could be and hold our institution accountable for helping, you know, my niece when she goes to college and future students after us. And so it was really, you know, a starting point and learning from the generations before us, just trying to make a model to show, you know, this happens everywhere and we can do something about it.
And in fact, Annie, if I'm not mistaken about this, and correct me if I'm wrong, you really didn't intend to talk about this. You didn't want to talk about this. In fact, it took you 7 years to reveal to anybody that you had been raped. You'd already left the university. So what made you decide that 7 years later the time was right to do something?
Well, I actually did tell a very few close friends and family members. It was, you're right, it was not something I ever intended to be public about. It was actually after Andrea reached out to me. I had graduated. I was working as a very low-level administrator on the West Coast, actually. And I heard Andrea's story, and then I heard my students' stories and hearing their pain and their experiences so much mirror my own and recognizing, you know, like what I was saying previously, that UNC was a microcosm. This was happening on both coasts, everywhere in the country. And I was also at a point where I felt like I had a responsibility and I had a privilege. I was no longer, you know, I wasn't living in fear of a perpetrator. I had support of a tight-knit community and I could speak out. And I think that's important to recognize that a lot of people can't. And a lot of times the media will say, you know, you should speak out or you should report or you should do X, Y, Z. And it's honestly a privilege to be able to even have this conversation with you. So I just felt like I could do something, and it was the time.
So what I'm hearing, Andrea, is that you were the spearhead here. You kind of corralled lots of people who had been involved in this and pushed toward this. But the two of you filed this Title IX complaint against the school in 2013, and that was pretty landmark. Why did you feel that filing a Title IX suit was the way to go?
Well, it's funny that you called me a spearhead. I was just a very passionate RA, you know, and I cared a lot about my students and you know, my residents and my job. And, you know, really, we used the resources the university gave us. I mean, we used the coursework material that we, you know, were using during our classes. We used our school libraries. We used our school printing to print the complaint and mail it. And, you know, our whole goal behind filing a complaint publicly and doing so without legal representation and really putting our faces and our identities to this issue was to show others around the country and really around the world that this happens to everyone and that you can come forward without these legal resources, without this monetary backing, because this happens to everyone and it's really on us to come forward and help pave the way for others that want to as well.
Terry Rhodes, this happened at UNC Chapel Hill and you, of course, are at UNC Charlotte, different branches of the same institution. Mm-hmm. When this was going on, when this Title IX suit was going through the courts and in the aftermath when it was decided, what kind of reverberations were going through the university system at the time because of this?
Well, I think that UNC Charlotte has also been ahead of some of the reactions. So we had already started to try to change some of the resources and to bolster the resources on our campus before the Title IX case. I think that the Title IX case has sort of prompted people to get more active and more quickly bring the resources mm-hmm. into sort of the place where they need to be. So I think that it certainly had an effect on campuses across the state, and it also it had the effect of, okay, we're doing stuff. Let's continue to do mm-hmm. more. Let's, for example, we have a person on campus that her position was created out of the Safety and Security Committee on our campus probably 5 years ago. So before the Title IX case that happened in our state, we were already trying to figure out how to have better resources for students who experience relationship violence and sexual assault.
Annie Clark, you and Andrea Pino, your partner there in Washington. You are not attorneys. At the time you filed this suit, Annie, you were, as you said, a low-level administrator at a university on the West Coast. And Andrea, I believe you were still a student. You had no money. How did you stumble upon the idea to file a Title IX complaint, which I guess would a win would threaten school funding if they didn't cooperate? How did you come up with the idea?
Yeah, I'll let Andre explain the idea, but I want to back up a little bit and just talk about Title IX for a second. Mm-hmm. For any listeners who might not know what that is or associate it in a different context. And so Title IX is an educational equity law. And all it really says is that you can't be discriminated against in an educational setting based on your sex. And so a lot of people think, oh, Title IX sports, you know, we have a football team, we need to have a women's volleyball team or something like that. And in our research, what we found was that all it really said was that you have an equal access to education. And there was a case at Yale called Alexander versus Yale, where five women, and we were five women who also filed against UNC, filed a federal complaint and or lawsuit saying that because they were subject to sexual harassment, they couldn't access their educational resources equitably. And we said, okay, well, if you can't access that with sexual harassment, of course you're not going to have an equitable access to education if you are sexually assaulted. And that's just not a one-time thing. That's, you know, do you not study at the library at night? Do you change your major? Do you move off campus? Do you not feel safe in a certain classroom because your perpetrator is there? And so thinking about that, you know, Title IX is really an equality law. And so just wanted to give that framework before Andrea starts explaining how we stumbled upon it.
Okay. Andrea?
Yeah, and how we stumbled upon it was as students. I mean, I happened to be a political science major, as was Annie, and I was actually in a class on feminist political theory. And one of the sections of the class was learning about Catherine MacKinnon, who was kind of the mastermind behind using sexual harassment. Sorry, in the context of Title IX.
Now, as I understand it, this is considered to be a landmark case credited with sparking a national movement. And in fact, it got the attention, obviously, because of Title IX, of colleges and universities across the country. What has been the result of this action? Well, how have things changed?
Well, in terms of our case is still under investigation, as are over 200 other cases. And that's really, it's a major shortcoming of the law. It's its enforcement and the fact that, you know, most of these cases last an average of 4 to 5 years. And by that time, students are likely to be off campus, either have graduated or have dropped out. And in most cases, the university will engage in a voluntary resolution in which they, in many ways, just promise to never do it again. But we see there's oftentimes recidivism among these universities. A good example is Florida State and the University of Virginia that have been under investigation multiple times in the past 10 years. So we see, unfortunately, it's really hard to keep momentum going, at least historically, because these investigations last so long. And we know that the turnaround rate is just so quick on college campuses.
Most of what we know about this comes from the media, at least for what I know about it, comes from the media, unless you're involved in this as the perpetrator or as the victim of this crime. But you are at the university level, Terry Rhodes. So explain to me what appears to the layperson as being a pretty lax approach to this up until recently. Recently, at college campuses, where the victim is really left out, hung out to dry.
Mm-hmm. But before responding to that, one thing I just wanted to follow up on is, and you asked what the result was. What's the impact? I would say the impact is that it's changing the culture. It's changing the way we think about sexual assault. It's changing. Certainly survivors' ability to speak out, to claim it, to say this happened to me, and to try to get resources.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one main thing. It's not a direct result of a particular case, but it's allowing survivors to say what's happened to them and to seek the resources.
So we'll come back and get an answer to my question to explain what was, from all accounts, a fairly lax approach to this up until recently about this on college campus. We will take a break and come back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Duke Energy, providing grants and employee volunteers to work with local charities and outreach organizations. More information at duke-energy.com/community. Recently, the Supreme Court deadlocked over President Obama's immigration plan to shield millions of undocumented immigrants from deportation. It was described as the biggest legal defeat of the president's administration, and the result could reach into the lives of many of the 300,000 people who are undocumented but living here in North Carolina. So we're going to take a look at the impact of this has already had for local Latino youth and what it means for their future on this program tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the latest on the deadly attack in Nice, France. Then Monday marks the first day of the long-anticipated Republican National Convention. Trump delegates and heightened security. What's ahead in Cleveland?
That's the Diane Rehm Show, ahead from 10 to noon on listener-supported public radio, 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about sexual assault on campus and the way things are changing in terms of how universities and colleges approach accusations of sexual assault. With Andy Clark and Andrea Pino, they're co-founders of End Rape on Campus and co-authors of We Believe You, Survivors of Campus Sexual Assault Speak Out. They're both alumni or alumnuses, or is it? Let's alumni, isn't it? They're both alumni of UNC Chapel Hill. Terry Rhodes is with us. She's the Associate Director and Director of Training at the Counseling Center at UNC Charlotte. So, Terry, explain to me what apparently to the layperson on the outside seems like, up until recently, a very lax approach toward this on college campuses around the country.
I think it might be related to the fact that the estimate is less than 5% of sexual assaults get reported. So it may be related to the fact that we don't think very much of this happens, which is not true. Sexual assault happens pretty frequently on college campuses. So I think that's part of it. And there's a lot of things that are happening on campus, our campus and other campuses, that have to do with education and programming to try to change the culture of what allows sexual assault, what facilitates sexual assault to happen.
But as I understand it, at most colleges and universities around the country, when this was reported and when victims came forward and they wanted help from the college or university, it usually went to some kind of a body that was formed by the faculty and students to deal with cheating and things like that, and not to deal with crimes.
Right.
This is a crime. Mm-hmm. Why is the university or a college involved in it at all? Why isn't it automatically referred to the justice system?
Well, it's also part of you're talking about the discipline committees that meet to adjudicate in some ways infractions of the student code. So if it's happening on a college campus, you're absolutely right. It is a crime, and it's also a way that students don't provide the discipline. They don't get an all clipped here. Yeah. It's a way that students don't they don't keep their conduct in within the.
Is it still handled that way today at UNC Charlotte, at other colleges and universities around the country? Does it still refer to discipline committees of students and faculty?
That's one way that it's
why
responded.
Why isn't it referred out?
Well, there's more communication between the campus police and the community police. You know, to be honest, in terms of this is a crime and what would happen to it if it went to the community, many of sexual assaults that happen in the community don't ever make it to court because of lots of reasons in terms of sort of a bias against the.
What's your take on this approach, Andy and Andrea?
Yeah. So just to explain a little bit, if you are a survivor of sexual violence and you're in a school, and we know this happens way before college, schools in primary and secondary education also have to abide by Title IX. But if you are a victim and you come forward, you basically have two options. You could go to the school, you could go to the criminal justice system or the police, both or neither. And what we know right now is we're dealing with two very broken systems. And so the reason that the school deals with it is because of Title IX, because you are a student, because you are impeded for your access to education, essentially. And a lot of students don't want to go through a lengthy, arduous criminal adjudication process, which Terry mentioned. Most of them never hear a day in court, and even fewer of them are ever prosecuted, as seen, you know, even when you do have witnesses, such as the Stanford case recently. you know, that was seemingly a perfect case, and this perpetrator got, you know, 3 months. And so your shots are very low. And a lot of students just want to be students. And the police aren't going to do things like move your chemistry class or move your dorm room. And so you have this option of going to the university saying, you know, I want help becoming a student again. I just want to move my room. And the police aren't going to do that. And if they do any criminal adjudication, it's going to take a very long time. And a lot of survivors, you know, because we live in a culture that blames the victim, don't want to face that shame or stigma in speaking out. And so you have these two broken systems right now, and thinking about the criminal process, particularly for women of color and trans identified folks who are actually at higher rates being victimized, don't trust the police for very good reasons. And so I think we need to do better both on the criminal side and on the school side.
One of the things I want to say really quickly is just looking at our archaic rape laws. I mean, North Carolina is a good example that we talk about all over the country, in which penile vaginal penetration is what counts as rape in the state of North Carolina. Everything else is considered a sexual offense. So it might lead to less time in prison if there is any at all. So, you know, a lot of our rape laws are very antiquated. In Alabama, it's considered penetration of the opposite sex. So why would a man come forward? You know, why would a woman assaulted by another woman come forward? You know, when their laws on the books just do not give them space.
Let's talk about what we're talking about here then, because we're not just talking about rape when we say sexual assault on campus. Is that correct? We're talking about other things, correct? The Bureau of – you're nodding at me, so I'm saying that's yes. The Bureau of Justice Statistics defines sexual assault as including both rape and sexual battery, such as forced kissing, touching, grabbing, or fondling. It seems to me that this raises some very difficult questions on the part of the people involved in all of this, both the perpetrator and the victim, if those are the correct words to use. Not to be too indelicate or insensitive, but you're dealing here with the young people who are exploring their sexuality. Is this removing all spontaneity? How do you deal with this as a young person if you're out in a situation where you're not abducted in a wooded area, where you're on a date or you're at a party, and this kind of behavior begins? How do you deal with it?
Well, I'll respond to that in some respects. It's less about whether it looks like violence. All crossing of sexual boundaries are considered violence against the other person. So we start with consent. We start with affirmative consent. We start with changing the understanding.
But are you supposed to ask at every move? And I don't mean to be indelicate, but seriously, you're supposed to say, may I do this?
Well, one of the things that we can teach people is that we teach people respect for another person, and that each person has the right to consent and remove their consent and bring their consent back and back and forth. So there's nothing assumed. I mean, there's some obvious ways to think about consent not being there. Mm-hmm. So, and
go ahead. I'm sorry.
For example, if someone's unconscious, for example, if someone is under the influence of substances. So teaching students, having programs around, let's talk to one another as people instead of as objects.
In settings where this is happening, between people who know each other, not strangers who pull you off a path in a wooded area and rape you, but in settings where this is happening, who are the people involved generally? What is the setting? What is the circumstance?
I was looking at some of the information about I'll call them rapists, who the perpetrators are, and they tend to be in a couple of categories. One category is the more intentional, planful sort of predator who is looking for somebody who's vulnerable, who they can take advantage of, who they can assault. And then there's a less planful perpetrator who is in a circumstance where he can get some, and mostly I'll say he, because mostly the perpetrators are male, where he can get some sort of influence and support for acting in a way that he may not generally act in.
So encouraged by
others.
He gets
encouraged, sure.
It's said that 1 in 5 women is or will be the victim of sexual assault, 20%, while 5% of men will be sexually assaulted while at college. Where do those statistics come from?
You know, I think they really do reflect the reality. And I think what's interesting is that, you know, this whole concept of consent ruining spontaneity, you know, in many ways, it's been, you know, it's been framed like that by the opposition, by mm-hmm. the people who consider themselves falsely accused, who said they were having a, you know, 20 minutes of action in which, you know, his life was ruined because a woman came forward. But, you know, this isn't new. This isn't a new phenomenon in which women in particular have been asking, you know, to reframe the conversation around rape, because rape is not sex gone bad. Rape is not sex. Rape is a crime, and it should be looked at that way. And it shouldn't be looked at as just the people, you know, who are assaulted in an alleyway. You know, I was assaulted by a stranger, but I was assaulted in a safe location, on a college campus, at a school party, when there were people around me who were educated, who were fellow Tar Heels, who knew what was going on but didn't do anything. Mm-hmm. And in many ways, even my case, in which it was a stranger, still wouldn't be considered to be enough of a crime, enough of rape. And that's exactly what it was like in the Stanford case. You know, when she talked about all the questions that they asked her, and even in her case, in which the jury was unanimous, in which there were two witnesses, in which there was a rape kit, you know, it still wasn't enough. And that's how most cases are, you know, because there will always be people out there, the perpetrators, who will think that it was just sex gone wrong. But it's not sex, it's rape, and they're different.
Exactly. And I'll echo what Andrea says. And, you know, going back to the thing about consent, it's really not that hard. And I think we need to start much younger in talking about respect and bodily autonomy. And yes, you do need to ask at every stage. And it was just recently in some states, as recently as the past few decades, where it was still legal to rape your wife. And so I think we need to have that conversation about consent much earlier. But to address your question about statistics, these statistics have been around in independent studies since the 80s and 90s. And then recently, the American Association of Universities, as well as our own Bureau of Justice Statistics, so the U.S. government, did this survey and found exactly the same things. Between 1 in 4 and 1 in 5 women will graduate or drop out of college, not only with a degree, if they do graduate, but with the title of survivor of sexual violence. And I really think, you know, that number is striking, but it's also true. And sometimes we do get pushback on those statistics, and people say, well, it can't possibly be that high. You know, it might be 1 in 10 or 1 in 16 or 1 in 50. And I would just ask, you know, what number would be acceptable? If we were talking about, you know, MacBook Pros and 1 in 50 students, if you went to college, your laptop got stolen, we would have a much bigger conversation. And yet this is a felony, and it's still contained, and people aren't talking about it in the way they should be.
UNC Charlotte is ranked 7th out of 10 schools with the highest total number of rape reports, behind Brown, UConn, Dartmouth, Wesleyan, UVA, and Harvard, but ahead of Rutgers, New Brunswick, the University of Vermont, and Stanford. UNC Charlotte's figure stands as 1.2 reports out of 1,000 students. What does that say to you?
To me, it says, I'm going to put the spin on it, that includes that there are more people reporting because they feel safer. I think that we have more resources on campus. I think that there's been a shift, and there are continuing to be shifts in our college campus atmosphere.
So more reports of rape is a good thing.
It's a good thing as far as getting resources to students.
Is it also an indication that there's an increased number of these incidents occurring, or is it simply that more people are coming forward?
I think it's the latter. The Title IX cases jumped from 9 to about 120 in the course of a couple of years, when we became more educated about what that was and how to do that and how to help students do that to provide the resources. So I think that it's not that there are more rapes. It's more that there are more rapes being reported.
So when students are coming forward, when UNC Charlotte is ranked 7th out of 10 of the highest number of schools reporting rapes, it is rape. It's not just sexual assault. It's not just fondling or unwanted kissing. And it is rape.
Correct.
Historically, I understand, rape has been lumped together with these other offenses. Is that true, and has it been separated today?
I don't know about the legal pieces of it in terms of what constitutes rape, but I think that it's about the reporting to whatever the resources are, dean of students or to the police. So it could include some of the other sexual harassment and the other sexual violations.
Coming for you in your book, Annie and Andrea, we believe you. You're survivors of campus sexual assault. Speak out. You've assembled. I'm not sure how many because we didn't get a copy of the book in advance, but you've assembled a group of young women who have been assaulted on campus, and coming forward in a public way has got to be incredibly brave and very daunting because there's shame associated with this. There is he said, she said associated with this. There are people who don't, who simply won't believe you associated with this. How did you get these people to talk to you?
Yeah, what's really sad about our book, We Believe You, well, first of all, it's amazing. These are, we have 36 stories, and they are some of the most incredible, amazing, and inspiring people I've ever met. But what is sad about that is we could have written 100 books, because mm-hmm. this is happening at those rates, the 1 in 4, 1 in 5 rate. And we actually just don't have women. We have men. We have folks who identify as transgender. And what we really wanted to show with this book is that it does, and obviously we're on radio and you can't see me, but when the media portrays sexual assault, oftentimes it's a person who looks like me. I am a white, blonde woman, right? And that's what the media portrays. And what we wanted to show is this is not the reality. It happens to women of color, to trans people, to men at high rates as well, and really reflecting their stories and their own voices, unedited by the media, talking about things like race. You can't talk about sexual violence without talking about Black Lives Matter. We have to talk about religion, immigration status. If you report and you're undocumented, how does that work? So we really wanted to put all of that in their own voices in this sort of New Age anthology. And then I just want to go back a little bit and talk about what you're talking about, sexual assault and rape and the reporting numbers. I would actually very much agree with Terry that I think it is the latter when you said that more people are coming forward. It's not necessarily happening more because sexual assault is a crime that is so underreported. It's hard to know that. But I would look at the schools who have, you know, 20, 30,000 students who report zero. Mm-hmm. I think that is a huge red flag. Mm-hmm. Whether it's, you know, 32, 33, you know, that can be debated. But the schools who have zero, it either means students don't feel comfortable coming mm-hmm. forward, or the schools intentionally or unintentionally underreporting. And that's a huge red flag.
Hmm. Your book is simply titled We Believe You. Why the title?
Well, unfortunately, survivors are very unlikely to hear those words when they come forward. And oftentimes mm-hmm. it's because of these large societal issues of what is rape? What is sexual assault? You know, there is no hierarchy to sexual violence. All these experiences where someone's body has been violated, in which their consent has been taken away and their life has been changed is an experience that merits being believed, that merits being supported. And unfortunately, when we speak to survivors, we're told that we're oftentimes the first person who says those words. So we want those that pick up this book and even those that don't even read it, that just walk by the bookstore and see the title, to know that they're believed and to know that it's not their fault and that they're not alone.
And exactly what Andrea was just saying, I know previously, Mike, you had said, like, well, it's rape, it's not just fondling. And that just puts it in a hierarchy and a categorization. And I know there are legal things we have to adhere to, but just to know that anybody who is a survivor of violence, that's still painful. And to anyone listening, that we do believe you and that what happened to you wasn't your fault.
That's Andy Clark, who together with Andrea Pino are co-founders of End Rape on Campus and co-authors of the book We Believe You. Terry Rhodes is here from UNC Charlotte. We're coming right back. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Doctors Making House Calls, over 75 clinicians making more than 85,000 home visits annually, providing comprehensive primary care to patients in their home, workplace, or senior community. Information and registration at doctorsmakinghousecalls.com. Today marks the first day at the long-anticipated Republican National Convention in Cleveland. Donald Trump, delegates, and heightened security. What's ahead in Cleveland? The topic of the conversation in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on the Diane Rehm Show. If you'd like to join our conversation, now's the time. You can email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org or search for WFAE on Facebook or get to us through Twitter at Charlotte Talks. And we're coming right back.
This week, Republicans will convene in Cleveland to nominate Donald Trump for president. NPR and PBS NewsHour will be there, too. We're teaming up to bring you live coverage each night. I'm Rachel Martin. Join me, Judy Woodruff, and Gwen Ifill for speeches, interviews, and analysis live from the Republican National Convention. Special coverage from PBS NewsHour and NPR News.
Tune in nightly beginning at 7 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about sexual assault on college campus and the changing approach to that, one would presume, across the country, at least hopefully, but one would presume that, with Andy Clark and Andrea Pino, Executive Director and Director of Policy and Support and co-founders of End Rape on Campus. They're both alumni of UNC Chapel Hill. Terry Rhodes is with us in our studio. She's Associate Director of the Counseling Center at UNC Charlotte, where she's also the Director of Training. They just said, Terry, that their book is called We Believe You, in part because it's the first time many of these victims have heard that phrase when they tell their story. Talk about that for a second from your point of view.
Yeah, it's really important. There's two reasons why this is important, why their book is so important and so powerful. It's first of all, it's powerful for the survivors to tell their story, to get their information out, to sort of break the silence and say, I'm not going to be ashamed of this. I'm going to actually say what happened to me. That's so empowering for survivors. And secondly, it's powerful for changing and shifting the culture, shifting the community to say, so it helps to educate the community that this is happening and that we want to find ways to stop that. I've worked with tons of survivors, and about half, it's estimated that about half of women who experience sexual assault on campus or other places develop PTSD. And this is the largest population that develops PTSD, which with very, very serious kinds of symptoms. So even larger than the military vets, which is surprising to people.
That's incredibly surprising, actually. Your organization, Andy and Andrea, End Rape on Campus, says that no survivor should ever feel that they should have to report or should have to become public in order to be believed. What does that mean?
That means exactly what I was saying a little bit before, that speaking on the radio or going to a protest or sharing your narrative publicly should not be the staple in order for a police to take your report or mm-hmm. your friend to support you or your family member, you know, to believe you. And, you know, this is something that is still so stigmatized. And so when somebody shares with you that that they have been a victim of childhood abuse or sexual violence in some way, to say, I believe you, it's not your fault, and you're not alone in this. And to really give that person back their control, because sexual violence is an act of power. It's not about sex. It's about violence and power and control. And to really give that person options and saying, you know, if you want to report, I'll support that. But a lot of times people either can't report because in their state, they don't quote unquote count, or they don't feel safe reporting. And, you know, what we know about, you know, victims of crime, sometimes it takes a long time. Sometimes it takes weeks, days, sometimes even years to come forward. So really supporting that person and making sure that their voice and their and that you're sharing options and resources with them, not making decisions for them, is very important.
Even as sexual assaults were on college campuses were coming under the microscope and seemingly being taken more seriously and prosecuted more vigorously, and shame was being removed and retribution seemed to be being removed, along comes the Rolling Stone story a couple of years ago about an alleged rape at the University of Virginia, which was later proven to be false. What kind of impact did that have on your movement to encourage victims to come forward? Did that put a pall on things?
I think it had only as much of an impact as the media wanted it to have, honestly. It's something that the media have been so obsessed over, when really there have been issues at UVA, you know, in the past 10 years that haven't even gotten a fraction of the coverage. You know, the case with Yardley Love, who was abused by her ex-boyfriend, later murdered by him. You know, the series of complaints that were filed before that. But unfortunately, I think if anything, the Rolling Stone article just showcases how much of a problem the media really have in covering this issue, and how they are so focused on covering it episodically as if they're only singular crimes, rather than covering it thematically and looking at these bigger themes of sexual mm-hmm. violence and harassment, but also inequity and oppression on college campuses, and how it is that there are systemically students that experience harassment and crime at much higher rates and are much more likely to not be as successful as students because of the crimes and harassment they have to endure every day.
Give me some examples of that, because as you say, it's episodic. We hear about this when some big case hits the media. So what happens what's the murmur like? What's the undercurrent like?
I mean, HP2 is a great example. I mean, what is it like to be a trans student on campus and not mm-hmm. being able to go to the restroom in your building? What's it like to not be able to live in a dorm room and feel safe there? What's it like to be a Muslim student and have to fear for your life after the shootings in Chapel Hill in 2014? I mean, there are, you know, these undercurrents of harassment and violence at college campuses all around the country and really around the world that are making it very difficult for students to remain students when they are busy surviving every single day. And it's really not about the incidents of harassment and assault themselves, but the fear of that. What does it mean mm-hmm. to not be able to take night classes? What does it mean to not be able to go to the medical school to do research at night because you're afraid of being mugged or you're afraid of being stalked and harassed? What does it mean to be a female student and be the only one in your program and having to be subjected to harassment from both your peers and faculty because you happen to be the only one? You know, we know that there are, you know, these dropping numbers of women in the STEM field, you know, both in academia and professionally. And that's because it's simply unsafe to be a woman in the STEM field. It's simply unsafe to be a woman in academia. And it's because, you know, there are these undercurrents of what it means to be successful in that field. You know, what does it mean to have to deal with?
Is it fair to make a blanket statement like that, that it's unsafe to be a female student in the STEM field?
Yeah, I can tell you that. I mean, I can tell you that, you know, from just, you know, just in our book, I mean, the people that were in the STEM field in our book, you know, the amount of women who have had to deal with harassment and trying to be successful in their fields. I mean, if you read our book, you'll have people from all different areas of academia and all different areas of professional life. You know, whether they're med students or they're students in the sciences, or they're even students that are off now in the workplace and are having to deal with constant harassment and fear for their life. I mean, it's the daily reality of being a woman. It's a
what
daily
kind of
reality.
What kind of harassment are students having to put up with in a classroom setting or in a conference setting with other students and faculty in which the harassment is such that they fear for their lives?
I mean, this was my daily reality as a student at Carolina. I mean, I stopped jogging at night. I used to be a journalism major, and I, in many ways, dropped the major because I had to take a lot of classes at night, and I felt unsafe when there were assaults reported near my residence hall. You know, my junior year at Carolina, 5 students died. One was raped and murdered, and until this day, Faith Hedgepeth, we've yet to hear what happened to her. You know, and that same weekend, I mean, there was a rape reported across the street from my residence hall. I mean, it's a daily reality of trying to survive on campus. It's simply not safe to be a female student because it's not just the fear of assault, but all those moments in which it could have happened.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, go.
That's okay. I'm just going to say Terry's been nodding in recognition as you've been talking here. So I'd like to hear, Terry, from you. These are very serious allegations.
Yeah, I think that what Annie and Andrea are talking about speaks to rape culture and sort of the attitude.
What is rape culture?
It was a term that was coined in the 70s by activists and the women against violence movement and feminists that basically says society blames victims for sexual assault and normalizes sexual violence. It's a set of attitudes and beliefs that are almost automatic, that we just believe that sexual assault and violence against women is inevitable and acceptable. So we have to push on that. We have to really change some of that to change the campus climate.
I know you're at UNC Charlotte, not UNC Chapel Hill, which mm-hmm. has painted itself as a little piece of heaven. but they're not painting it that way. They're painting it as a big piece of hell. Mm-hmm. So would you say it is unsafe to be a female student? It's unsafe for them to take night classes either at your campus or the other campuses in the system?
I think that it's always in the back of our minds as women uh-huh. that the threat is there. And if the threat is there, then it impacts our lives. It impacts what we do. It impacts the decisions that we make.
Real or not, if the threat is there, if you feel threatened, then it impacts the way you think and feel and act.
And the decisions you make about, well, maybe I'll take this class at noon instead of at night. And, you know, this notion of real or not real, a threat is real because people have been assaulted.
So what policies has the University of North Carolina, because you work for them, put in place not only to deal with accusations of rape and sexual assault, and the investigation of those accusations and the prosecution of those accusations, but to make female students feel safer and less harassed, if that's the right term?
Well, it's limited in terms of the bite to it, but there are policies against misconduct. And I don't like the word misconduct because it sort of minimizes it. So sexual misconduct and harassment and stalking. So there are disciplinary policies against those behaviors.
Are students given instruction in this, either when they come in as freshmen or refresher courses as they come back for each succeeding year?
Certainly. Students are in their orientation. They get so much information. They get tons of information.
Right.
They get information about the student code, clearly. They also get re-information about it when they're in the residence halls and in some of the early classes, the freshman seminar classes. And
does it take? Have you seen a change in attitudes, a change in behavior?
I think it takes some. I think we need to do more. So we need to have more programming and more sort of like the bystander programming. That's a new programming area that we're exploring on.
What are you hearing from around the country, Annie and Andrea?
Yeah, I think, you know, a big issue is, yes, a lot of students are being educated about this at orientation in college. But if we're talking about this at first year orientation, when you're 18 years old, it's way too late. Children have been socialized. They've been learning about sex through porn. In North Carolina, where I went to school, we had abstinence-only education. People aren't getting anything other than what they're learning and absorbing from the media, which is typically really sexist and harmful. And so I really think that framing is important of how we teach children this. Starting at a very young age, you know, we're talking, you know, my sister's a kindergarten teacher in North Carolina. And, you know, we have talks about this all the time, how parents say, well, you know, boys will be boys, or he hits you because he likes you. And that framing, you know, when girls are removed from their classes because their shirts are, you know, not wide enough, you know, on their shoulders, they're removed from their classrooms and then say, you know, why are you dressing like this? You're distracting the boys. Fast forward a few years, you're sitting in a police office and saying, you know, why did you dress like this? What did you expect? And so I think we really need to entirely have, you know, a very large frame shift where we stop saying, you know, women, this is how you protect yourselves, and instead say primarily to men, this is how you treat other people. Because this doesn't exist in a vacuum. You know, college campuses are to some extent, you know, insular and bubbles, but it's also very reflective of the culture that we're living in and reflective of the previous 18 years before somebody steps foot on that
campus. So give us a primer here. I'm not sure how to do this because I think this is very confusing, and maybe it's less confusing for younger people, but this is a foreign concept to me. I never felt this in college, and maybe that was because it was 152 years ago.
I don't really think it's a time thing. I think it's a thing about power and position and privilege.
So give us a primer on expectations, how men and women should treat each other, how they should act toward each other.
You shouldn't assault people.
Of course not.
And if that is confusing, then this is a very good case for education much earlier. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, what we expect, particularly if you're in a position of privilege, whether you're white or male or whatnot, you expect racism to look a certain way. It's not racist if it's not KKK, right? But there are these currents of microaggressions, whether that's in communities of color, whether it's against LGBT Americans, whether it's against women. And like Terry was saying, you know, to male listeners, you probably don't think about, you know, walking to your car at night after your job. But to a lot of female listeners, you probably do think about walking alone at night and thinking about all the ways that you're protecting yourself and your daily life, even if it's not very conscious. So I think, you know, those undercurrents that we're talking about might not be as visible to those of us who do live in positions of power and privilege.
Do you think that you have been, I don't mean any disrespect by this, but do you think that you have been super hypersensitized to this because of your personal experience?
You know, I've been hypersensitized since I came out of my mother's womb. You know, that's what it's like to be a woman, frankly. I mean, you wouldn't know that, of course. But it's just growing up as a woman, I mean, you are taught since birth to be hypersensitive, to take care of yourself, to monitor the way you speak, to monitor the way you dress, because everything that happens to you is your fault. Mm-hmm. And that's just the reality of growing up as a woman. And that's the reality of growing up as a person of color in this country, that you are taught by your family how to act to avoid crimes done onto you. Mm-hmm. And that's just how it is, unfortunately. And that's how it was when I got onto campus. I mean,
mean, all the things that I could have done differently, how I could have held my keys, what pants I could have worn, what dress I could have worn, what shoes I could have worn. And it still happened to me because it's my fault and I deserved it. So I'm not hypersensitized. And it's just, it's the reality. It's the reality of surviving in this world as a woman. It's the fact that you are avoiding crimes done onto you. And it's unfortunate because, you know, oftentimes, especially, you know, male listeners will say, well, you know, you're being hypersensitized, or, you know, maybe it's just sex gone wrong. But in reality, while there are male listeners who are talking about, who are criticizing women who are saying that we're being hypersensitized or that we're ruining sex, you know, that's because, you know, they're being called out for behaviors, you know, that we are trying to avoid every day. We are trying to survive, whereas they're trying to survive being called out.
What? Yeah. I'm sorry, Andrea.
Oh, I was just going to say, it's hard to understand a system that was built to keep, you know, people in privilege and power. And so if that's not your daily reality, it does seem sometimes like people are being hypersensitive, or how could you think this? Or, but I can tell you from, you know, my personal experience, but just experiences of friends, it's hard to understand that if you're not living it. But unfortunately for most of the population, that is our daily reality.
We have 30 seconds left. What do you want the takeaway from this to be? What do you want victims to know?
For me, for any survivor of crime, that they are believed that what happened to them was not their fault, regardless of what they were drinking, what they were wearing, where they went. It's not their fault, and that they are not alone in this experience.
Terry,
that's what I would
say. And Terry Rhodes, do you think the university is doing a good job of moving toward that position very quickly?
I think we are really moving in the right direction. And I would just say, let's humanize one another. Let's behave like we're all human and not objects.
Terry Rhodes is Associate Director and Director of Training at the Counseling Center at UNC Charlotte. Andy Clark and Andrea Pino. Andrea Pino are Executive Director and Director of Policy and Support, respectively, and co-founders of End Rape on Campus, and the co-authors of We Believe You. Thank you all for the hour.